This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Hurricanes as strong and wet as Harvey might become more frequent as global climate change progresses.
Warmer sea surface temperatures make more energy available for the formation of storms, and also the higher temperatures allow more evaporation out of water into the atmosphere, which will then eventually precipitate out.
Hear from climatologist and professor of geography Dagmar Budakova. Plus, a Twin Cities author and photographer has a new book out on New Deal utopias. Jason Roblando talks about greenbelt communities and the music of indie rock band Sherwood Forest. All that and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Many people have been struck by the strength and persistence of Hurricane, now Tropical Storm Harvey, still drenching the Texas Gulf Coast. In fact, the amount of rain that has fallen on the area is the most in a single event in recorded North American history. According to ISU climatologist Dagmar Budakova, people should not be surprised if more such events happen.
If you're thinking about climate change and global warming, scientists expect that in that new background state, you will have increased sea surface temperatures, increased atmospheric temperatures, and changes in atmospheric circulation that would favor the formation of large storms in general, including hurricanes.
How does that work? Describe a little more about the interactions of the elements that you just mentioned.
Warmer sea surface temperatures, which is what we have seen, particularly in the Gulf of Mexico now and in months leading up to now, make more energy available for the formation of storms, and also the higher temperatures allow more evaporation of water out of water into the atmosphere, which will then eventually precipitate out as rain.
Some people are wondering whether we're going to see more hurricanes like Harvey in the way that it has gone back offshore, recharged, re-energized, and then come back for a second round of really, really heavy precipitation. Is that something that you can also say will increase under continuing global climate change?
Well, what you're talking about there is the path of the storm in general, and I'm not aware that there's any research that suggests that storms would come on shore and go back to the ocean and go back on shore again. In the case of Harvey, the reason that that has happened is because of very particular atmospheric setup around Harvey, that we happen to have a high pressure cell over to the west and high pressure cell to the east, and that kind of is squishing Harvey in place and not allowing it to move basically or move quickly out of the way into other areas. But will that continue? I'm not aware that there is any research on that.
Will global climate change shift the overall patterns of the direction of weather enough so that we may see hurricanes and typhoons and in different places than we have traditionally seen? Now, obviously, that's not the case in this instance, because the Texas Gulf Coast is long been a target.
The northern edge of where storms can form can shift theoretically. It can go. Basically, the tropics are expanding, so to speak. So hurricanes theoretically could form farther north than they are now, and may land in different areas than they have been in the past. But I'm not aware of any research that actually shows that to be happening.
What other more extreme weather events than hurricanes might we begin to see or see more of?
I think in particular in the United States, what we are seeing has been an increase in the rate of rainfall that occurs, like greater downpours have been. We have evidence in the recent historical record to suggest that there is an increase in that, also over Texas and the South in general. While extreme precipitation is something we're more confident on than other things, also extreme temperature, like droughts and floods, we also have decent confidence on. But when it comes to other cyclones or tornadoes or even hurricanes, we don't have a lot of confidence yet because the data is just not there, the recent historical data quality, and then the length of the record. We just don't have it, and the models that we currently do have in part because we don't have historical record to verify them with, are having challenges predicting these events and simulating the events too.
How much more data do you need, and what kind of data do you need and how long will it be before we generate what you need to refine models?
Well, that's a complicated question. It all depends on what we're looking at, depending on if there is, for example, a climatic variable that we're looking at that shows a lot of variation from one year to the next in its occurrence. And when we're looking at extreme events, they're by nature extreme because they're rare. And so we have to have a lot of data, meaning at least 100 years of continuous reliable data before the signal, so to speak, comes out. And sometimes even that's not enough. So it really depends on what kind of an extreme event we're looking at.
What are some of the implications for this large, intense level of precipitation, of water going faster into the air and then coming down faster? What are the implications for human habitation and human agriculture?
The implications are great for infrastructure in general and also for settlement patterns. Once we know how exactly different regions will be impacted by, let's say, increased rainfall intensity, more extreme rainfall events, local governments can begin to plan and adapt to those changes and also can become proactive at mitigating the changes. So I think infrastructure has a lot to do with it, making sure we keep up with the changes, and we also fix what's already broken to begin with. And then when we're fixing it, we take these changes in climate patterns into account when engineers are planning for any kind of infrastructure fixing or update.
For example, roads or buildings, or what might need to be changed and how?
Well, I think that all depends on where you are and what the vulnerabilities may be.
Take, for example, in the South, since we have a hurricane there right now, we might be able to use that as a case.
I think one of the greatest challenges that we see in the South and in Houston in particular is the fact that a lot of people are settling in the area, and the development of urban development in general is increasing. And so as you are paving roads, for example, the surface is not as permeable. And so if you have increased rates of rainfall, that water, it's going to be very difficult for that water to drain away unless the infrastructure can support that. So that would be, I think, the fact that we have these many challenges is in part because there are so many people too who are being impacted.
There are projections of global increases in various places, not uniform, of sea level rises. What sort of adaptive strategies should humans use to think about those coming trends?
Well, I think that engineers always need to take into account the latest scientific information that's available and any changes in, let's say, rainfall rates that have been recorded by scientists need to be taken into account by engineers when designing levee systems or designing infrastructure to hold the increased intensity of rainfall that we may be coming to get in the future.
How will we know as this progresses over the next century or two, whether a levee is worth building, or whether we construct a new Venice, or whether we just play King Canute and don't try to hold back the waves.
I think that will be dictated by how many people live in those areas, you know, and what needs to be done to protect the populations of those areas. I think if these areas get continue to be settled, you know, city planners need to plan for potential downpours and potential extreme weather events that may impact how people live in those areas.
Do you think we as a species, though, are going to make a decision based on just solely science, or we're going to say, you know what, we have hundreds of thousands of people in an urban area near a low-lying area, and all that economic activity and all that attachment to a sense and pride of place that humans generate in their feelings of home? Or are we going to say, you know what, we shouldn't be living here anymore?
If we're not going to say that we should not be living in a certain place, which I realize is not that easy for the reasons that you mentioned, I think then that our city planners and politicians need to make the choices to protect people who do live there. So perhaps it's going to become more expensive for people to live in areas that are more prone to extreme weather events, pay more taxes, and get better infrastructure, but I think to protect the people should be a high priority.
How about the Southwest? I mean, we have a 1,000-year drought event that did away with the Anasazi civilization. Are we going to see something similar in the Southwest, in Arizona, New Mexico, parts of western Colorado, from global climate change?
Well, drought is the biggest issue in the Southwest. Whether we will see a calamity of that sort, that remains to be seen, on how well we adapt as a civilization and how we respond to the changes that scientists believe are coming.
What's the cautionary part of looking at Hurricane Harvey and trying to conduct an interview about global climate change?
Well, I think the most important part is to realize that Hurricane Harvey is just one incident, and not to extrapolate. It's important not to extrapolate that to all hurricanes, or just say, since an extreme event happened, it must be because of climate change. Climate change might have contributed to the occurrence of Harvey and to its character, but it's very likely that is not the cause of Harvey.
Dagmar Budakova is chair of ISU's Geography Department. She says extreme rain events have been becoming more intense and frequent across the country since the 1980s. In the Southeast, heavy downpours have increased by almost 30% over the past 60 years.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, GLTs grow. Greenbelt towns are three planned communities built by the U.S. government during the Great Depression of the 1930s. They're the subject of a new book by photographer and artist Jason Riblondo of Bloomington Normal. It's called New Deal Utopias. Riblondo says the cities of Greenbelt, Maryland, Greendale, Wisconsin, and Green Hills, Ohio, were built by the short-lived RA, or Resettlement Administration, as a housing solution to the dislocations of the Depression.
There are many other housing programs, but the Greenbelt towns were special because they were built in the style of the Garden City movement. And the Garden Cities were a set of design principles set forth by an Englishman named Sir Ebenezer Howard. And he put these ideas together in around 1898, in the late 19th century. He was appalled by the overcrowded slums of London, and he wanted to solve those problems. So his idea was to decentralize large urban areas and combine the best of the town and best of the country. So the town meaning the social opportunities of living in community with each other, but also the fresh air and open green spaces of nature.
So mixed residential and green space.
Yes, exactly.
Did the iteration of it look any different in the U.S. than it did in Great Britain?
Yes, it did. I mean, there was Letchworth Garden City and Welland Garden City, both north of London. They were kind of set up as worker communities. They're just set up a little differently. The gardens are more prominent and more kind of manicured. But the Greenbelt towns in the U.S., they are a prototype for the American suburbs, I would say.
Did that really go on to influence the suburban design concept, or was that going to happen anyway?
It may have happened anyway. I think the more interesting thing about the Greenbelt communities is that there was a social component to it as well as an architectural component. And when I think about the architecture of the American suburbs as we know them, as we think about them as a post-war phenomenon, prefab houses, and to my knowledge, I don't think there was a social component that was as strong as what the RA had planned.
What did this social component look like?
It was built for cooperation. The architecture was built in terms of cooperation and community. The residents were chosen. There was some sort of social screening, and some might say social engineering involved as far as whom to select for these model cities. They wanted model citizens. They wanted them to chip in and be more neighborly. So they wanted people who would be good for the community and help each other out.
How did they determine productivity, communality, community-mindedness?
They asked. they asked, but also, I mean, there were pretty heavy surveys, but also they were intended to be for displaced farmers and poor urban dwellers. However, they needed a population that was stable and bound to be successful. So they didn't want any sort of risk involved as far as a New Deal program failing. And they wanted young couples with children, people that were stable and we're going to be there for the long haul.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Jason Roblando, the author of New Deal Utopias, a book about Greenbelt communities and the Garden City movement, a book of photographs about Greendale, Wisconsin, Green Hills, Ohio, and Greenbelt, Maryland. Who is Rexford Tugwell, and how did he come a cropper based on this program that was so carefully vetted to succeed?
He was one of Franklin Roosevelt's right-hand men, one of his brain trust. He was the former Undersecretary of Agriculture for FDR and a former Columbia University economics professor. And he was put in charge of the Resettlement Administration by FDR. And the way that happened is part of his kind of lore and controversy. FDR created the RA, the Resettlement Administration, via an executive order. And that gave Tugwell kind of unchecked authority over his program. So he wasn't bound to congressional checks and balances. So people were very critical of him. He was a lightning rod of controversy. But he thought that he was in a good position to change the American way of life, built on those principles of cooperation.
And you know, Republicans in that era would probably sniff a socialist there.
Absolutely. And they call him Rex the Red for a reason. And there were supposed to be, he envisioned hundreds of these cities across America.
He didn't last that long.
He did not last that long. It was a two-year tenure at the RA.
This is not uncommon for New Deal programs that became a little too hot for Roosevelt to handle. There were a couple of other theater startups that he also had to walk back and kill after a while, too.
Right, right.
What was the concluding straw that broke the camel's back for Tugwell?
I think there were a lot of straws. I think by 1937, the cities were about to open. They started construction in 1935, and 1937, he was canned. There was supposed to be a fourth Greenbelt community outside of New York City in New Jersey, and there was an injunction to stop that. The citizens around that area didn't want this European Bauhaus housing, and they didn't want to live under what they perceived as lower-class people. And the RA and the and how it was created was called into its constitutionality was called into question. And I think at that moment, Tugwell had just put the pedal to the metal and says, let's get this done. But you know, throughout the project, there were lots of cost overruns. He was constantly defending himself, saying, you know, this is not only a housing program, but it's a jobs program as well. We're putting people to work. So I think that's a really interesting take on what the government could and should be doing for people who are in trouble.
Having started this utopia, and the federal government owned the land, and they continued to own the land through the final one was turned over to the citizens and the public in the 1950s. That seems a long, lingering legacy, doesn't it? Tell us about that.
A lot of the businesses were run cooperatively. People in the post office were federal employees. They are federal employees. But people who worked in the theater and people who worked in the and the cooperative were considered federal employees. And people were also worried about tax breaks that they might be getting as far as like who is collecting the taxes and who does that go to. But the bigger concern was, as far as the government ownership, the competition that it would give to the private market. And you know, those echoes of that kind of ring today as far as how people are perceiving the Affordable Care Act. So these political divisions, you know, are as old as time itself, I suppose. I mean, you can go back to the Roman Senate.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The author of New Deal Utopias is Jason Roblondo of ISU. My impression of many of the photos is that they're remarkably uncrowded. In the images of buildings, they're portrayed sparely and cleanly. When there are people, they're not generally in large groups. The colors aren't busy, but rather in large blocks or swaths. Is that impression of your approach accurate? And if so, what are you trying to tell us?
I had made my initial trips to the Greenbelt towns. I was just floored by how green they were, how many parks there were, how many trees there were. I felt like I needed to step back, both conceptually and physically. And I was concentrating on the architecture, and every now and then, someone would approach me, and I would photograph them. And there's a handful of portraits in the book, but for the most part, the people have receded into the distance, and they got smaller and smaller and smaller, and then they kind of disappear. And I was thinking about how people envision utopia, and utopia is a, you know, very broad, messy subject, but I was also thinking about how urban planners might see something as a new start, a utopia as a new start, and how there's always a break where they're trying to bring order to chaos. And I think that's what was in the mind of Tugwell when he thought about these new suburban landscapes, this kind of pioneer spirit.
Having created the order, though, this New Deal utopia and the embodiment of the Garden City movement, you're photographing 70, 80 years down the road when that universe has aged. Entropy has had its way in some fashion. Was that part of the contrast that emerged for you, or were you trying to recapture what was rather than what is?
A little of both. That's a wonderful question. I mean, I think that utopia itself is an impossible concept, and we're always chasing it, and it's unattainable. I love people's attempt at it. And even when it's as close to reality as possible, even idols age. Even there's an image of a water feature at a pool in Greenbelt, it was a kind of a late summer day. There are just signs of age, and I'm not sure when that water when that water feature was put in, but there are just little signs of rust on it. And I kind of want to emphasize that these things don't last forever. But I love that the spirit of these towns are alive and well. And, 80 years past its founding, there are lots of residents in these towns that love that New Deal legacy and the spirit of cooperation. And this connection to history.
Is it markedly different from any other healthy functioning community, though, this spirit of solidarity and community involvement?
I think there's something special about the relationship between these three cities, that they were kind of born out of the Depression, and they were born with each other. And when I traveled from Greenbelt to Green Hills and to Greendale, there were similarities in a lot of the architecture, but the people, they were very interested in why I was there. When I would converse with them, they would say, like, oh, Greenbelt, how is Greenbelt? And I'm like, oh, they're fine. They say hi. So it really is like they were sister cities. And I know that a lot of cities have these relationships with a city abroad, and then they send stuff each other back to each other. But I think the shared past and why it was created, it means a lot to them. And they will have celebrations of Roosevelt, and they'll have little kind of retro days. It's something that I am not familiar with in the places where I have lived. But I'm sure that there are people who are interested in history and their past in every community. But the shared past that cuts across state, across three different states, I thought was pretty interesting. When Tugwell retired, he was the governor of Puerto Rico for a little bit after his stint at the RA. But he ended up retiring and living in Greenbelt itself. So I think he really wanted to put his money where his mouth is and live that dream that he envisioned.
Jason Reblondo is the author of New Deal Utopias and a Bloomington Normal-based photographer and artist. Reblondo is also the guest Instagrammer for Smithsonian Magazine until September 1st, sharing images of the three Greenbelt towns. That account is at Smithsonian Magazine. You can see photos of Greenbelt towns also at WGLT.org.
If you bring the bike, we'll bring the light. Every bike you bring to the 5th annual Light the Night event in Uptown Normal September 7th gets a free front and rear light. Bring the bike, and we'll bring the light. Bring the light. While there, get a bike safety check and get freebies from Connect Transit for trying a bus bike rack. GLT, Good to Go, Connect Transit, Bike Blono, and the Town of Normal are partnering for Light the Night September 7th. Find details at WGLT.org/good to go.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Trees add beauty and privacy to our yards, but they can also screen our property from harsh weather. Patrick Murphy has more on this edition of GLT's Grow.
Trees are a beautiful and practical way to screen your property from fierce winds. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field, from the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum. It's Patrick Murphy. Hello, Murph.
Hi, Laura.
Today on GLT's Grow, we have a question about trees as windscreens from Peter in Lexington. He submitted this at WGLT.org/grow, and he's concerned, what with white pine diseases and a warming climate, he wants to basically start planting now for windbreak trees that will be good in the next 40 years. So clearly he thought white pine would be a good idea, is concerned with diseases, so he's looking for other suggestions, or maybe we should stick with white pines. So let's talk about some trees that might work for Peter.
It sounds like a great situation to be in, especially out in Lexington, Illinois, which is northeast of Illinois State University. Great area.
Mm-hmm.
Windbreaks are very useful if you live in an open setting or a rural setting or even agricultural setting. That's kind of how windbreaks got started. Windbreaks are a continuous wall of vegetation that extends or continues to protect an area from wind, snow, unfavorable views, or unfavorable lines of sight. They also create shade. So it's a good practice to have. Windscreens and windbreaks, they can reduce wind, and they can also help prevent soil erosion and prevent the soil from drying out too quickly, because windscreens, the primary thing they do is reduce wind. So there's one little detail I thought was interesting we could talk about, is the distance that the wind is reduced is 10 times the height of your screen. So if you have a 10-foot tall screen, you're going to reduce the wind's speed by 70 to 80%
wow.
for a distance of 100 feet.
That's not bad.
So that's kind of cool, but there's a couple more things to keep in mind, Laura. There are a couple kinds of windbreaks. There's a field windbreak, and then there are farm windbreaks, and they can both occur at the same place because, like I said, farms are where they happen the most often. A field windbreak would happen where it's more landscaping oriented, but it has the same benefits of controlling soil and moisture erosion. Whereas a farm windbreak, and if you're driving across the country, and especially if you're on a bicycle where your view lasts a little longer because you're going a little slower, the farm windbreaks, they protect the home and the outdoor working areas, the feedlots and where the animals live. They protect those features or those living things from the stresses of wind. So if you work on a farm or something, you're outside a lot, you need to have an environment where you can do some work, and that's usually where the feedlots and stuff are located too.
You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. This week, trees as windscreens. Now, Peter in Lexington seemed rather bullish on white pines, but are there other great options out there for him?
There are. So when you're putting your windbreak plan together, Peter, I want you to keep in mind that your windbreak, it has three or four layers. So having a windbreak made out of one plant, as much as we all love the white pine, that's not a good practice, because right now there's nothing that's really significantly reducing the value and reliability and usefulness of white pines, but that could change. Okay, so we'll compare that to, say, Austrian and Scotch pines. Man, they are dying all over the place.
Ooh.
So if you have these windbreaks, consider mixing several species together for the protection of diversity.
Great idea.
So your four layers, or three for sure, possibly four layers, you get your windward row portion of your windscreen. That is a spot where you're into the wind, you're meeting the wind.
Right.
And for the real, real elaborate, super effective windscreens, they kind of are pyramid shaped. They're tallest in the center, and then they taper on both sides.
Okay.
So that windward row, if it were trees, the white pine would be a good one. But some little less tall conifers might be better for that first layer, as well as dense skeleton deciduous trees, like, say, a hawthorn.
Ooh.
A hawthorn's like a thorn basket. You can barely throw your hat through it.
Okay.
So you could mix a couple of trees in that first windward row, and then your interior row, that's where your largest plants are located. So that's for sure white pine location, as well as a mixture of some large shade trees, you know, some oaks, some black gum. Some of the good, valuable hardwood trees that we have in the Midwest would be great for that interior row.
What about arborvitae?
Arborvitae would be good on the windward row side or the leeward side, the downwind side, because if you can imagine the wind coming up to a fence, the wind goes over the top of it, and when it falls down, if there's snow in that wind or rain, most of it gets dropped when the wind is forced back down to the ground after clearing that hurdle.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if your hurdle has little layers on each side of it, you're picking up rain and snow and even soil particles that were picked up off your field or have just been carried in by the wind. It gets slowed down by the crescendo of that interior row, and then the leeward row does the last of the fighting. And if you're really, really planning it out, you can do your windbreaks so that they include a snow trap. So the snow trap is something that's, say, 25 to 65 feet away. This requires some measurement because if it's too close, so if it's less than 25 feet, you're going to drop the drift right on what you're trying to block or screen. If it's too far away, the wind has plenty of chance to speed back up. So in addition to the white pine, you've got the white fir to add to these three or four layers. And for that snow trap layer, this is also a good opportunity to create something that's beneficial for the living things that we share the landscape with. So this could be where you find some of your edible plants like gooseberry, American hazelnut, dogwood, native dogwood trees, you know, like Cornus racemosa, the gray dogwood. So a really effective windbreak would not only have the white pines that Peter loves, but it'll have some other short-needled conifers in there, some dense skeletal deciduous trees. That way, when the winter's here and the leaves are gone, these pieces are all still working together.
You know, I'm a huge fan of the blue spruce. Would that work?
Absolutely. That could be in the windward row or the interior row.
Mm-hmm.
So now we've talked about blue spruce, white pines, and white fir. That could be
a lot of great choices there.
And arborvitae. So there's four right there. That continuous line is going to have a nice natural appearance to it if it's not just the same soldier, shoulder to shoulder to shoulder.
Yeah, that has a very, like very planned out sort of Versailles. I mean, there's not that there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah.
Very formal to have them all the same. And if you're really attracted to that, I mean, okay.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to mix it up as well, you've got a whole lot of different textures and heights and all kinds of things going on there.
That looks nice. It lasts the longest. It's the most effective. Diversity is the key in so many things that we do in the landscape, and it's certainly true with the windbreaks.
Absolutely. Now, Peter, that was a great question.
Thank you, Peter.
We loved hearing from you. And we love hearing from anybody who's got a great question. So, you know, that's always welcome here on GLT's Grow. Now, next week, you know, a lot of people are harvesting their melons and enjoying them this time of year. But let's start thinking about the next growing season. And we're going to talk about preparing a melon patch for the next growing season. If you're not growing melon right now, this might be a great opportunity for you to start getting that ready for next year. Maybe if you're just thinking, I'm tired of dragging a watermelon home from the grocery, I want to grow my own. Well, we got a plan for you coming up next week on GLT's Grow. And of course, your questions are always welcome. Just send them to our website, wglt.org/grow. We'd love to hear from you. Murph might use your question on the air. And we'd love photos too. It's wglt.org/grow.
Get timely gardening advice weekly with the Grow Podcast at iTunes and WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Bloomington Normal indie-based rock band Sherwood Forest has just released its second EP. Band founder and frontman Clifford Close stopped by the GLT studios to give John Norton a taste of No Retreat.
I wanna know what's on your mind. I wanna know what's taking all this time.
So we're listening to the title track to this new album, and Clifford Close is in the studio with me right now. First of all, welcome.
Hey, it's good to be back.
No Retreat, the title track, and I hear it as a couple of people who have, you know, been in a relationship for a while, they're really working on this thing, and then one of them is all of a sudden getting cold feet, and the other one's saying, no, hang in there, we're doing good.
Yes, definitely, because I wanted the whole song to just kind of represent the struggles of fighting for a relationship, you know, relationships that matter most. And so the whole song is just coming from that perspective, like, hey, I know that you're having a hard time, but I really believe in this, whatever this is, and so let's continue to fight for it, you know.
Any chance this is a metaphor for the band itself?
I never really saw it that way personally. That is an interesting take on it, but
I mean, you guys have been building and building, working hard, you're performing, this is your second EP now, and anyone getting cold feet yet?
It is a struggle because, well, for one thing, Sherwood Forest, you know, it started as my own solo project, so it can be, you can have those moments like, oh, are people really into it as much as I am? Because, but I understand it though, because each of the members, we're not full-time musicians, and we, you know, a lot of us are in school. A lot of us have, like one of us has, like, three jobs. I don't know how he does that. But it wouldn't be a shock to me if all of a sudden some of them were like, yeah, I can't really do this. And which would be, it would be hard to deal with. And I would rather to keep us all together. I'm just going to continue pursuing my dream. And if, you know, if they have to pursue their dreams, I'm totally cool with that. But we're still bros.
Could escape it if we tried. Now I'm working on the ropes that you untied, and I don't know.
This is your second EP. The first one was a 3-song. This is a 5-song EP. What was different about recording this one compared to the last one, if any?
Well, for one thing, and this makes me super, especially proud about this album, is that it was all self-produced. We didn't have any outside help or anything, as opposed to the first one. We had our friend Sammy, who helped us out with that one. And this one, we just had total control over it. We just recorded in our own homes. It can have its own struggles. Like I said before, we're not full-time musicians and everyone just has their own schedule, which is why kind of took so long to finally get this out.
Clifford Close is our guest. I'm John Norton. This is GLT Sound Ideas. The brand new album from Sherwood Forest is called No Retreat. You said you didn't have any help on the album, but you brought some guests in on one song. You worked with Tourists.
Yes.
On Ballad of a Saint. Is this an original song of yours?
It is. In fact, I would say it's the oldest Sherwood Forest song.
Your words are pretty on the stage to everyone who hears. You get nods of acclamation and bringing them to tears.
It was a song that I wrote like 3 or 4 years ago, and it's a song that we've performed for a long time, but never recorded it. And it's had its own kind of evolution, but it's basically stayed true to its original feel. And yeah,
it's an Irish jig.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And
is this the way you've been performing it without Tourists as well?
Or? Uh-huh. Yeah. We have yet to ever perform it live with Tourists. I would love for that opportunity at any time. But yeah, it was just a new idea. It was like, what if we just collaborate? Because I love Tourists, and you know, we've discussed before my love for Irish music. So I just kind of pitched that idea to the band, like, sure, let's give it a shot. And it was a whole lot of fun. We couldn't get the whole group of Tourists, but a couple of their members came over and just recorded their own thing over it. And it sounds awesome. I usually get chills whenever I listen to it.
Yeah, it gives us a little bit of a different twist from the rest of the songs on the album, at least musically. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
It's pretty cool.
Oh, once the saint always remembered by the
watch as I. You can never amend the things you do or release the friends you tied. So watch your hands and watch your feet, be careful they go. Don't contradict your words of faith, cause everybody knows. Oh, a lot of you here, a lot of you high, a lot of you here.
When we talked last year for that three-song EP that I referenced, we talked a little bit about your religious background, but it really isn't overt. I hear hints of religious things here and there, even on some of these songs. Am I imagining that just because of our conversation before, or do you still wrestle with that at all?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you're right. A lot of the songs on this EP, especially, it creeps in there, even though I might intentionally not keep it so obvious. Like the song Outside, it kind of just tells a story of how I've struggled with getting outside of my comfort zone and just having complete trust in what I believe in, and having no fear of, you know, of holding back.
Getting anxious of leaving and of what's in store. It's my hand you're holding, you're what I live for.
Ballad of a Saint, even, is kind of a rant that I wrote, directed towards Christian leaders who kind of have they can live a double life. And I kind of wrote this when I just kept on hearing stories about this. I'm just like, man, you have to lead an example, and then you're doing all these things that kind of contradict what you're teaching.
Well, let me go back to Outside. There is just a line in there that really caught my attention. Maybe I heard it wrong. And I feel so much better. And I'm not feeling any better.
Yeah.
And did I hear that right?
You did. And even though that first line is repeated at the end of the song, what I wanted to portray was, you know, that first time I feel so much better and I'm not feeling any better. It was more like that first time that it's mentioned, that it's more of a bluff, you know, more of a like, oh, yeah, I'm totally fine, you know, because at the beginning of the song, the narrator is telling the story of how, you know, I'm fine where I'm at. I'm fine at the place that I'm at. I don't want to go outside of this. And, you know, I'm totally fine where I'm at. And then that second chorus, like, maybe I'm not so great. When the end of the song comes, I guess it just kind of, I had hoped to communicate the fact that I'd actually had come out of my comfort zone. And yeah, this is so much better than what I was experiencing before. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Is this personal or with the band?
I'd say personal. We're, as a band, we are, you know, always experimenting and always never really being afraid of, you know, going outside of our comfort zone, at least stylistically. I think a lot of our songs are very, very experimental. That's what I like about Sherwood Forest, about what we do, is that we never really do the same thing twice.
Well, the songs sound great.
Thank you.
This is a fantastic album. I want to play one more before I let you go, Clifford Close,
absolutely.
Okay? Tin Can. Let me play just a line in here, okay?
I ain't singing just to hear you clap your.
So there's the line, I ain't singing to hear you clap your hands. What are you singing for?
Well,
by the way, good line. I like that line.
Well, thank you. This song was, I kind of wanted to use an allegory to portray a message. And that's the struggles of being a musician, a striving musician.
It's like a busker, a street busker.
Like a homeless guy who's trying to make a living out of music, and he's just kind of stuck playing his music on the streets. And while, you know, music is definitely a passion and it's just something, if we could do it for free, yeah, totally. But the way that the world is, you can't really do that. Like, if you want to make a living out of it, you need some cash flow, honestly. And it's not coming out of like, I want to be rich and famous. It's more like, if I want to continue doing what I love, then I need someone to give me a chance, you know, to just give me a break. And so that's what that line means, is that like, yeah, your applause is awesome and I really appreciate it, but that's not all I'm doing it for. If I could do, you know, get all that for free, then totally. But it's not the case. It's not how the world works.
No Retreat is the name of the album. Sherwood Forest is the band. Clifford Close, the band founder and leader, thanks for stopping in.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks.
Sherwood Forest founder Clifford Close speaking with GLT's John Norton. You can purchase the band's new EP, No Retreat, at sherwoodforest.bandcamp.com. You can discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One of your favorite podcast app. Our website is where you can find the individual interviews from Laura Kennedy and John Norton at WGLT.org. Let us know what you think of the Sound Ideas Show. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is WGLT Normal 89.1 and WGLT.org.